Stage. And it's been called hilarious, unsettling, and poignant. Invasion returns with the original cast to Milagro Theater this week, and it closes this week. Showtimes are Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 7:30 p.m. and a late-night performance Friday, June 27th. For tickets, visit badasstheater.org or call 503-358-4660. All performances are at Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark in Portland. And you can find out more at badasstheater.org. And we have a pair of tickets to offer to the third caller here at KABU at 503-231-5106, 231-5106. Third caller can get a pair of tickets to Invasion. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to KABU engineer Janet Anderson. And I'll have the show later online today at stageandstudio.org.
Have a go. I'd like to be a gallery. Put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Add him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Bruce Gunter, the chief curator at the Portland Art Museum. Bruce is here to talk about the art of the Louvre's Tuileries Gardens. Welcome to KBOO, Bruce.
Nice to be here, Joseph. Thank you for asking.
This show is about a garden, but it's about art within a garden. But we need to know why there's a garden in the first place. And a lot of people know the Tuileries in downtown Paris, but we don't really know which building was there first. What was the palace?
It's an exciting exhibition because it takes you to a place we all know, either intellectually or emotionally or experientially, the Tuileries Garden in the heart of Paris. It was once the outskirts of Paris. And where the garden begins was the medieval wall that protected the city in the 1550-1560. Catherine de' Medici, the wife of Henry II, widowed. Her husband died in a joust in a rather bloody splintered lance in the head. And she becomes the regent for her 10 children and the three sons that would later become kings of France in succession. And so she decides as a widow to build a palace outside the medieval wall on the edge of the Seine and build an Italian garden. Her memories as a Medici, the daughter of Lorenzo II, she builds a walled garden, a series of rooms, a grotto, a series of fountains that remind her of Italy and also provide a place for social life in the outside the royal court, which was at the old building of the Louvre in the heart of the medieval city, behind the wall. Her freedom then was to take people and the politics of the age. This is the great age of the Huguenot and French wars in which Protestant and Catholic face off for 100 years. She moves that intrigue into this garden, this series of walled rooms and boxed, hedged gardens, formal. It reminds one of the Boboli Gardens when you see the design. She built a palace that backed up to the medieval wall. The medieval wall is eventually torn down after she's gone, and it becomes part of the larger city as the city moves out of the wall and surrounds her garden, literally, with cityscape. But that would take 200 years before it was really fully developed. So we're celebrating this garden, which is a palimpsest of history, a reflection of that social history, and the aesthetic choices and decisions that are made across 400 years.
The palace was burned down in the Paris Commune in the 1870s.
Yes. It's a rather spectacular event. You know, that's the end of the Franco-Prussian War. France loses. Napoleon III is discredited. The city of Paris votes to become a republic and to oust the royal family from the Tuileries Palace, which is the royal residence, and declare a new state. It lasts 8 months, and it ends in a bloody battle in the Tuileries Garden. And one of the sculptures in the exhibition shows the bullet holes from that event, and a series of spectacular albumen prints show the garden and the palace before and after the commune, when it is burned to the ground. And that's why it is the ghost in the room, the memory of something that was so integral to French history, placed on the edge of a garden that was developed for the pleasure of the king and becomes the pleasure of the world today.
The landscape architect or garden designer was André Le Nôtre. What else did he do?
Well, you know, André Le Nôtre, the son and the grandson of gardeners, became a garden designer and engineer, and in a real way, one of the first kind of technically educated and aesthetically and practically trained gardeners. He was appointed by Louis XIV, the Sun King, to redesign the Tuileries Garden for the pleasure of the king as he sat in the Tuileries Garden, in the Tuileries Palace. He went on to famously design the Great Park of Versailles. So those great hedgerows and rooms and fountains and grand axial perspectives, which were designed by Le Nôtre, become known as the French formal garden. It is a landmark place in the history of gardens itself, and juxtaposed against the French notion of the informal garden, the ha-ha, the kind of pastoral mix that English gardens develop against this notion of French formalism.
So the Tuileries Garden is the precursor to, yes, Versailles. So it's a bit more formal and a bit smaller, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. You know, because it's built inside the medieval wall that Catherine de' Medici built for her first garden. Eventually, Louis XIV and Louis XV take down the masonry wall and replace it with a wrought iron fence, and it opens itself to the city that's developed around it. Mm-hmm. And the style changes. You know, great French design from Le Nôtre is a matter of a grand axis, cross axis that then mark zones in the garden. And Le Nôtre's plan was to see the terrace at the palace. You descend the garden to a formal parterre with embroidered kind of hedgerows and flower plantings with three basins, different sizes, but from the palace they looked, because of perspective, the same. And then a grand axis between these bosquet of trees, which are take the medieval idea of walled rooms and line them with trees, on out. Eventually, he lays out what would become the Champs-Élysées, because he wanted, the garden was a little short, unlike Versailles. And so he extends the vista of the grand axial view from the palace all the way to the point, literally, where the Arc de Triomphe would be built by Napoleon. And it was simply five rows of trees running up a hillside with farmland on either side. But it created the illusion of the extension, the manipulated man-made extension of the garden in front of you. It was a grand plan, which he takes to Versailles. And that's what we experience today when we go to Versailles. Mm-hmm. Endless walking.
As you go in, there's a big tapestry which shows a royal procession. What's going on there? Was the garden at that point a staging ground or an exhibition place for military affairs or royal events?
Absolutely. You know, one of a set of 12 tapestries commissioned from designs by Lebrun, by Louis XIV, to celebrate his reign. And the tapestry we have represents the 12 months and the horoscope sign. So it is Scorpio, October. And the device of the tapestry is the Tuileries in the background, Louis and his entourage coming out of the palace through the garden, mm-hmm, up to what appears in the device as a pavilion looking down on the scene, where courtiers are carrying baskets of late harvest, squash, apples, mm-hmm, pears, the kind of the bounty of October. And in the foreground, a series of mad animals. I mean, wonderful. There's a civet and an anteater.
A lynx.
A lynx and a guinea pig and a bunny.
And a raccoon. Is it a raccoon?
Yes. And that's an allusion to something that Louis XIV was quite famous for. He had built two world-class menageries. and which were much copied in England, Germany, in the Central Europe, because they were state-of-the-art menageries for the time. And so the animals on all the tapestries are different, representing parts of his collection. So it's a way of this tapestry, which sets the power and the grandeur of the monarchy against the palace and the garden, but then with the king's own personal pleasure sort of arrayed at the bottom.
Right.
Sort of insider-outsider jokes. All sorts of things.
Those tapestries were contemporary scenes.
Yes, absolutely. They were contemporary history. They were, in a way, without the digital age and Facebook and Instagram, the recording of events of significance. They live at Versailles, and so we borrowed this tapestry, which is over 23 feet long and 11 and a half feet high, to sort of capture the sense of the grand patronage, but also the role that the garden and palace played in history.
There are a lot of statues, and they're not there of classical themes, but why did they put so many statues outside?
Well, you know, Le Notre designed a garden without statues, a series of urns and markers to note where the entrance to the alley or the bosque or the terrace were. But during Louis XIV's grandson, Louis XV, when he moved to the palace as a five-year-old in a regency, they decided to move sculpture from other royal residences. And so the works in the exhibition once started their lives in Versailles and the Chateau at Marly, and were moved at Louis's order to the garden in Paris, because it was his primary residence. And so what happened is the 18th century saw them as an essential part of the garden. And so it's the moment when the garden becomes an open-air museum. Mm-hmm. It is one of the first sculpture parks.
And it is public? Any old peasant go in there?
Well, there were dress codes. I mean, it's sort of like going to a nice restaurant, coat and tie. Well, no, but during Louis's reign and his grandfather's, Louis XIV, parts of the garden were open for this public spectacle, like the procession you talked about in the tapestry, where the public would witness events of state, the arrival of the ambassador of the Ottoman Empire and all of his turbaned entourage as they sweep into the palace and through the Tuileries garden, entering from the Place de Concorde at the north end, sweeping through the garden up to the palace. You know, that would have been witnessed by nobility, citizenry. And it becomes, in the 18th century, a place for major events, like the first balloon ascension. Over the course of 1783, there are a series of balloon ascensions in the Tuileries garden, which are witnessed by literally thousands of citizens of Paris.
I was amazed. I didn't think balloons started that early.
Yes. Well, in fact, Benjamin Franklin witnesses the 1783 balloon ascension. And in his Poor Richard Almanac, Best Voice, he says, "You know, I think this is going to change life as we know it." And you think, well, Ben, you're kind of right, because the balloon ascension then becomes a device for pleasure. It's a scientific exploration. But eventually, those same balloons would bomb Paris with firebombs that would be dumped in one of the wars that go on. They would use them as aerial assault.
Some of these statues are called herms. They're a torso and a head on a kind of plinth. And there are allegories, Francois Barrois.
Yes. Yes.
The allegories of the seasons. Why were they placed around there?
They were originally at Versailles, and when Louis XV moved them, they ended up marking the main axis across the Grand Basin at the north end of the garden at the Grand Basin. And there are allegories that are based in part in Ovid's Metamorphoses. And the herm as an article type goes back to Roman times, a column that ends in a partial figure of usually a demagogue or a character, metaphorical and so, like autumn or winter and summer. And these have a kind of a subtext, Pomona, the goddess of bounty and the harvest, had decided in her way that she would ban men from her garden and her life. And Vertumnus, or Winter, comes to her disguised as an old woman. And there's a fragment of the mask that mm-hmm. once adorned his face in his right hand. And it, you can see where it was attached to his chest. And he is revealed at a moment when he has, disguised as an old woman, he gains access to the garden, and he engages her in a dialogue about the usefulness of men and the pleasures of men from his perspective of an old woman. And when Pomona says, well, perhaps I should, and her mind is changed about banning men, he reveals his masculine vigor and appeal. And mm-hmm. so you see in the Herms, his cloak and the mask come off, and he's a fine specimen of a stone man.
There's a vase. Would you call it a vase? A big stone urn.
A big stone urn, yes.
With a relief of children around it, but it's got a bullet embedded in it.
Yes. The garden has been through five wars, and it's an interesting moment, being in the heart of the city and at the edge of the royal palace. The revolution courses through the garden. The masses take the palace. They force Louis the 16th to live in the palace. He walks his last walk to the guillotine and the Place de Concorde through the garden, to the jeering crowds. The bullet comes from the Commune, when the palace was stormed, and then the army of Versailles, under the leadership of Napoleon III, retakes the city, and a major battle. 5,000 people died somewhere in the vicinity of the Tuileries Garden, either in the battle or were executed summarily mm-hmm. in the garden. And so a number of the sculptures bear the brunt of that activity. World War I and II changed the garden as well, and the sculptures became centerpieces of sandbag fortresses or buried. And there are photographic evidence by some of the great 19th century artists, Ager, Nader, Daguerre, that record what happened in the garden through photography, the new medium, the new voice of modernity.
I'm Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Bruce Gunter, the chief curator at the Portland Art Museum. Bruce is talking about the art of the Louvre's Tuileries Garden, which is in Paris. And the exhibition runs through September 21st. Bruce, you brought in a bit of music that's relevant. So what is it?
Oh, there was a wonderful piece of Mussorgsky's about the Tuileries, and David Sheffrin played it at the opening, and it's going to be part of a program at Chamber Music Northwest. They're doing a special French program at the museum as part of the Tuileries and inside the Chamber Music Northwest performance. And so Mussorgsky's Tuileries, it's a short bit of music that captures the spirit of the flaneur, the dalliance in the gardens, the progression of the people across the garden. It's a marvelous piece.
That was Mussorgsky's Tuileries from Pictures at an Exhibition. Bruce, you talked a bit about photography. There are a lot of interesting old photos going back to daguerreotypes. Why are there so many photos in there?
Well, you know, this was the interesting thing for me as a curator, Joseph, that this is one of the first historic exhibitions in which we could showcase photography as the important medium for understanding two centuries of a place. photography, which was discovered in 1837, was perfected in Paris. The minute photographers were able to go to the streets, they photographed the Tuileries Palace and garden. It became part of the set piece of the vocabulary of landscape and then eventually genre pictures. So the first photograph in the exhibition is 1840, 3 years after photography is discovered. It's a full plate daguerreotype of the palace. And so this excited both myself and Julia Dolan, our minor white curator of photography, because this is the largest group of early 19th century photography we've been able to present. It comes from the Musée Carnavalet, and they have the largest repository of French 19th century photography in existence. Superb images, many of which have never been seen in certainly the 21st century, but in even the 20th century, because when you have 8,000 attaché photos, the chances are you haven't shown these 20 that we're showing.
So that would be the picture I remember was Tuileries and Pont Royal, and it was the full plate daguerreotype, 1839.
Yes.
So you're just looking at it's like the riverside and a palace and you know, walls and stone that look kind of like they do today.
Yes, there's still moments in Paris that reach literally back 200 years. Mm-hmm. And it's, if not 500 years, and that's the point of the exhibition. How do we know a place, our own experience, the documents that photography has provided us, and before that, painting and tapestry and sculpture. And so this exhibition tries to lace together those parts of our knowing into a narrative that is like a river and its locks. There are moments when the river runs free and the ideas are generated and the objects and the space give you one experience. And then we pull you into a place that is, as an exhibition, manipulates you, that lifts you from one level to another, from one age, from Catherine de' Medici to Louis XIV, to Napoleon III and the Victorian age, and then into modernity, the age when the garden itself becomes public realm completely. Mm-hmm. And it is with the commune and after, in which the garden itself is fully open to the public. The things that we know and love about the garden become a reality. And so this exhibition dances between art and history, a garden, its design, and a city and its life in, I think, a kind of beautifully lyrical way. None of it pounds you over the head. And photography, to return to the subject, is the key to that, because we see over the course of almost 200 years that photography's been around. We see at each moment it capturing the essential energy of the place.
There is a huge statue of Hercules and fighting the serpent. And then just around the corner, there are photos.
Yes. It's a wonderful juxtaposition. The Hercules and Achilles by Bosio, he is one of the central sculptors of Napoleon I. He does the reliefs at the base of the Vendôme column, and he did the statue of Napoleon that was on top. He created Hercules and Achilles, which is, Achilles is the river god who changes into a serpent and battles with Hercules. It's a spectacular 11-foot high bronze. It looms over the exhibit, and to your right or left are documents. First, the historic vision of a painter in the same period as the sculpture. And then to the right, the photographers who were photographing the garden and the palace, who bring us the voice of the future. And so it's the juxtaposition of a classical nude, a figure out of antiquity, re-envisioned as a modern sculpture in the modern scale, next to the voice of modernity, photography.
Some of the photos are of the old, of sculptures. There's a return from the hunt. They're shot from like strange angles. You know, it's like someone's experimenting with perspective. Somebody, you know, carrying a deer, I think, over their shoulder. It's almost a silhouette. It's an amazing photograph.
Yes. Eugène Auger. We think of him as a documentary photographer.
And this is 1905.
He's photographing the 18th century sculpture in the 19th century garden, but he's looking at the developments in Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, the way modernism flattens down, uses the techniques of silhouette and the fragmented figure of Japanese to reinvent painting. He's reinventing photography.
The painting section, is it a section? I mean, yes. The paintings are towards the end. And some of the big names, Pissarro, Manet, why are they grouped together?
Well, it's a specific moment. There is a moment in the development of Impressionism and Post-Impressionism in which painters move to the garden because it's the closest bit of nature and building that they can celebrate. And so Pissarro and Monet both rent apartments on the Rue de Rivoli, which is right next to the garden, and they invent a way of looking at the city. Pissarro being explores it. And so we put the paintings together for you to see how Impressionism records the garden, how the changing seasons and light and place in the garden have a voice not only in photography but in painting. Child Hassam the American, who is a follower of Pissarro and Monet, is in Paris in 1896 and paints a spectacularly abstract picture of the promenade along the Rue de Rivoli at the edge of the garden, of women and children and men going about their business. The chairs that were first introduced in the garden in the 18th century appear in his painting that's on the verge of the 20th century. And so the paintings summarize in a way what the garden had become as a public zone, as a place in the heart and the life of the city, not simply a royal pleasure garden.
We're getting up to the contemporary age where we know it as tourists sort of walking around with our backpacks. It was a place 150 years before where there was electric light, there were parties.
Yes.
And it was a great people-watching place.
Yes, the garden has transformed itself. It's now democratic. It is a place for the world, not simply the Parisian, not simply the royal family. And so we see that. We commissioned, and the curatorial team of which I was part developed a storyline, and we commissioned a photographer to go out and to record a day in the life of the garden today. And it ends the exhibition on the note of what the experience of the garden today is about. It's cameras and knapsacks. It's goats trimming the gap in the landscape. They use them because the slope is it's about an 80-degree angle. And so the goats are the ones who navigate and keep the weeds down. We had to have that. We have some ducks. We have, you know, tourists. And then, you know, you also see the way that sculpture lives in the garden, the way the intimate moments of life, a stolen kiss, a solitary reader, the masses of people moving through the garden, animate this place, which is so steeped in history. You know, when you walk the Tuileries Gardens, you literally walk on the bones of the past, and you feel its continuity and its eternal quality as it changes every day, every epoch. And our goal in creating the exhibition and then the video that ends the exhibition was to bring it around full circle to that notion that place shapes our lives, our memories, and history.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO. My guest this week was Bruce Gunter, the chief curator at the Portland Art Museum. Bruce was talking about the art of the Louvre's Tuileries Garden. The show is on now until September 21st. Thanks very much for coming in, Bruce.
My pleasure, Joseph. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. We'll be right back.
Jackson County, Oregon recently faced off with some of the most powerful corporations in the world when local farmers led an effort to ban the growth of GMO crops. But a recently passed state law, first written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, means that, for now, no other municipality in Oregon may do so. Where did the ALEC bill come from, and how was it passed? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KBOO's investigative news team on Jackson and Josephine County's GMO bans on Tuesday, June 24th at 5:45, right after.